This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Maher. Little Alice Duncan grew up with the Mithika people on her father's property in Queensland's remote Channel Country early last century. The books she wrote about her childhood, long dismissed, have now been rescued by the historian Tom Griffiths as The Real Thing, a unique and intimate account of those people in that country at that time. Alice is dreaming later. But first, to that country of old men, the USA. Joe Biden was 81 when he froze in that debate with Trump and admitted, only after weeks of haggling, that he was too old to go on. Wily Mitch McConnell disappeared from Congress in June, won't say why, has yet to reappear, but is determined to hang on in there until just short of his 85th birthday. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, the oldest president ever inaugurated, sleeps through meetings, puts on pounds, and talks darkly of running for a third term in 2028. The great age of American politicians is no accident, according to my next guest, Samuel Moyne, for they represent an aging constituency that controls the political system. America, he argues, has become a gerontocracy, a nation where the old are richer than ever, are hoarding jobs longer, hang on to the best real estate, and are more powerful in politics, not least, to preserve their privileges. In his new book, Gerontocracy in America, Moyne, who's the Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale University, argues for strategies to break the grip of the old on his country, not by revolution and executions, but to do the job thoroughly and gently. Sam, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let's make something clear right at the start. You're a Gen X, is that right?
That's right. I'm in my mid-50s.
I'm a boomer. So I'll ask you to respect the old, even while you're seeing how best to strip them of their privileges. Can we agree on that?
I have a lot of affection for the old, and ever since I was a child and, you know, my grandparents were so kind to me, I would never attack any old person. Least of all you or myself.
Good. Sam, how has this come about? How has power and wealth and office moved up through the age brackets?
Well, there's an almost global context, which is what I call the great aging. And most places in the world, people are getting older and surviving longer than ever. And it's not that there weren't agers and super agers before, even the Bible mentions them. But the point is that most of us can expect to survive a very long time. And that's unprecedented, especially as in wealthy societies, there are fewer and fewer younger people. And so that's background, but different societies manage this demographic change better than others. In my country, it turns out that once you're elected to public office, you can stay essentially forever. There are very few contested races, and the advantage of incumbents is enormous. There are some political offices like judgeships, which are life tenured. And so we have specific features of our political system which are making the great aging toxic for our politics in placing too many old people in office too long.
But isn't it the responsibility of the parties, of the Democrats and of the Republicans, to make sure that there is a refreshment in the ranks? Surely it is to their advantage not to have these geriatrics hanging around forever.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think we can moralize about these things because they're really structural. And I think the Democrats stand for the society and the voters, and their leaders are well aware first that those who hold power in society, and especially those who fund elections in a privately financed campaign system like America's, are overwhelmingly old. And even more glaringly, the voters are elderly. In the United States, half of Americans are still under 40, but the median age of the voters is at least in the mid-50s, and in some races can trend as high as 72, meaning half of the voters who come out to the polls are older than 72, and half are younger. So it's a kind of staggering thing just how much the old are in power, quite apart from who's elected. And I think the Democratic Party recognizes this fact.
Isn't it, though, a key to power in the United States to get younger voters to vote for you?
It would be. It's very difficult. It always, in most societies, most democracies in recorded history, the older you get up into the highest reaches of age, the likelier you are to vote. But in the United States, it's gone far beyond even the norm. And I think younger people are feeling alienated by their gerontocratic political system. They look at their leaders, not just their presidents, but their Congress people, their senators in a branch of government literally named after old men, their judges who can serve for life. And above all, they look at the policy output of these politicians and are convinced reasonably that this is not a political system in which their voice matters, and so they don't use it. Now, I do think we should encourage every eligible voter to go to the polls. I even think we should lower the voting age and consider other, even more radical fixes. But I don't think it's helpful necessarily to think that it's just a matter of appealing to the youth to embrace their civic duty.
What happens in a gerontocracy? There's some grim stuff in your book, but one of the things, and it's a slightly different system in America to Australia, but you point out that the old aren't interested much in education.
So there are a lot of objections to gerontocracy. One is just that if the political class is out of step with the age of the voters, there's a failure of representation. There are very few politicians serving in the federal government under the age of 40. That's half the population effectively unrepresented by age. But then we get to distributional fairness, where most of the federal dollars, maybe 6 to 7 of federal dollars in spending for every one spent on children, are going to senior citizens. And then we look at issues. You mentioned education, where older people, and this has been documented, can be very generous for their own children and grandchildren, but not those of others. And they are especially concerned about taxes and immunizing their property from taxation. And then they also postpone the long term. And we're, of course, there are honorable exceptions. You may be one of them. But if you take an issue like climate change, the older you get, the less you care about it. And reasonably, because you will not live under the worst effects of a warming planet. And so why would you prioritize remediating it?
And you add to the long-term list, not much interest in dealing with the national debt.
And that's true.
And I know that there's a lot of joking amongst people my age of, oh, God, thank God I'm going to die before that problem has to be solved. I can leave that to the younger people. And, of course, those grim jokes include always climate change, this intractably difficult problem, leave it to the young. But As you argue, the people with the hands on the levers are actually the old. They are the ones that should be dealing with it, but they don't.
That's right. You'll remember from the history books that, you know, the French king famously said, "After me comes the deluge," as if, well, I will survive no matter what the future brings.
Yes.
It doesn't matter to us. But it matters intensely to younger people who, I think, you know, based on, you know, not just witnessing my own college age daughter's response, but just statistical studies, are feeling more and more resigned about the future that they have to wait to have any say over. And it's looking grim.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Samuel Moyne about his new book, Gerontocracy: How the Old Are Hoarding Wealth and Power and What to Do About It. Well, Sam, what to do about it? One of the things that's clear over the last decades is that a general expectation that you retire in your 60s has disappeared.
Well, that's for sure. And I think, understandably, we are just higher functioning. Doctors have approached their tasks by pursuing what they call the compression of morbidity, which means their goal is to save our deaths for the last stage and let us function well as long as possible before then. And that means that everyone can actually embrace the reality that they're better off than ever for longer than ever. And why should they give up the reins? Well, there are a lot of reasons why. They're being unfair to their successors. They may actually be in decline and in under a set of illusions about that.
Yes.
But they don't get out of the way because for them, they're ageless. And that's, I think, it's very sad that we have stopped thinking of our life as coming in seasons and taking the last stage. If we're well off enough to retire and our state is generous enough to help us in that last stage as a moment of reinvention, you know, the last chance to try new things, exercise our talents in different ways than we did in our profession. But very few are willing to transition anymore into retirement unless they really can't do their job or they're forced out.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm speaking for myself here, but, you know, if you enjoy the work, why not keep going for a bit longer? But you argue in the book that it is time to bring back age limits to all sorts of roles in the United States. How would that work?
Well, it's a very simple line in the sand. And it could be that we should willingly apply it to politicians, especially since, as with professions like air traffic control or airline pilots, where there are age limits, we recognize that the risks of cognitive decline or death in office are too great to tolerate. And it's not that we wouldn't lose some good politicians who are, let's say, unfairly cut off too soon, but we would manage our risks better. And there's also the fact that very few people are genuinely indispensable. I don't think Joe Biden or Donald Trump, either one, was. And there were many younger people who could now take their place. And so I don't think it's a great injustice to impose an age limit. And I think that's true in more or less any profession where those who are staying indefinitely in their posts, often with the highest salary and the least work, refuse to get out of the way and either block younger people from entering the profession in the first place or advancing while they wait around for the old man to leave finally.
There are age limits on the highest court in Australia, 70, constitutional.
Yes.
I think it's a bit young, actually, but at 70. US Supreme Court, no age limit. What was the impact of Ruth Bader Ginsburg hanging on in there?
Well, she was an icon. She had worked tirelessly as a jurist before she became a judge and once she was on the Supreme Court for women's rights. But then she made a fatal mistake, which was to bet on her own longevity. And the fact that she was replaced by Donald Trump with Amy Coney Barrett, an extremely reactionary jurist, meant the end of the federal abortion right. And so that was something we shouldn't have left up to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She had had pancreatic cancer, which is usually not survivable, and she had survived it, but not forever. And so in that case, the risks were so great. Now, like in Australia, and like in most countries in the world, the states of our United States often have age limits for judges, but our federal constitution prohibits them.
But your research suggests that there is actually strong public support in the United States for age limits.
There is overwhelming support. Upwards of 80% of Americans, and that's across generational lines, believe that enough is enough. They've seen not just Democrats, but Republicans, not just presidents, but senators and judges stay too long. And the trouble is that the very politicians who would have to act to do the people's bidding are not interested in doing so because they're aging themselves and they want to stay, and they have every advantage that the incumbency system essentially allows them in most cases to stay as long as they want.
Do you think that the great power of money in the United States system has a role here? Because the backers of the politicians, rather than risk a new talent, will hang on to an old.
Absolutely. The donors, the studies show, for our privately financed campaigns are alarmingly old. And in a sense, they rightly see buying a candidate as a long-term project.
There are limits on the use of money in Australian politics. And of course, everybody is expected to vote, which helps as well.
Mandatory voting is a very enlightened policy which Americans should adopt.
Indeed, indeed. But there is a similarity between your politics and ours, which is the hostility to immigration amongst the old, and that mm-hmm. division in our politics, that division in our society is very much an old-young division.
Mm-hmm. It's one that is one of the most interesting facts of gerontocracy. Here's why. I'm convinced that gerontocracy also hurts older people, and immigration is one of the best examples. It might be true that climate change has the worst effects reserved for after older voters die, but who exactly is going to pay for the benefits that older retirees reap from the state? Well, that's going to be, at least in part, as the youth population dwindles, immigrants. Who's going to actually provide the care that a booming generation of older Americans or Australians need in the end? That too is going to have to be provided by newcomers to the countries. And yet, the older you get, it's very well documented, the more hostile you are towards immigrants. And so this is just one of many ways in which a gerontocratic political system is not just hurting younger people and those in their prime, but older people as well.
You argue in the book that one of the sort of certainties in politics is that the older you get, the more conservative you get. That is breaking down in some countries. Australia is one of those countries. And it seems the longer you have to wait to buy a house, the less conservative you remain. You become conservative when you get a house.
Yes.
And that's changing the shape of politics. Is it not doing that in the States as well?
It is. I mean, I would clarify that if there's a general pattern, it's that age is correlated with what you could call small C conservatism. That means keeping things the way they have been, you know, a bias for the familiar, repetition, not experiments. And that could mean hearkening back nostalgically to a familiar past, which I think has united, for all their differences, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, both of whom hanker for an America of the 1950s. Yes. In many of their beliefs. I agree with you totally that acquisition of property, and especially housing, makes one much more interested in protecting it. And the facts are stark in the United States that the age group likeliest to own a home is 70 to 74. And this age group second likeliest to own a home is 75 and above. And the reason is that there's a crisis in supply because Americans decide on their land use decisions at the local level, where older citizens can come and block new builds. And then, of course, they stay in their homes even once their children have left and they have no need for the space. And so we have a conservative generation that has monopolized the housing and caused a lot of discontent, leading to some potential radicalism that old people will not welcome, but in a sense, they've helped make possible.
What about a scheme where the longer you stay in your house, the more tax you pay when you either bequeath it or sell it? I think that'd be quite a good idea, wouldn't it?
I agree. And it's not counterintuitive. And yet the fact of the matter is, in my country, the tax scheme is the reverse. Our tax scheme actually rewards you for staying in your home and waiting until you die to pass it on. And so that's exactly the wrong incentive structure to set up, yeah. And yet that's what we've done.
Same here. And therefore, this is a nation of empty bedrooms.
Yes, yes. Very sad. And so that incentive you mentioned seems to me imperative to reverse things so that older people have a good reason to move, and it's a financial reason.
That night that Joe Biden dried in the most agonizing way in the debate with Trump, has that started a new concern about age and politics in America? Is there now a sense that there wasn't before that this is a problem that has to be addressed?
Yes and no. I think it was a breakthrough moment. Many people, including me, starting to do the research on this book, had long been concerned about the age of folks in Congress or the judiciary. But Joe Biden's crisis really was a wake-up call, if you will. And that's why we've seen in this current election cycle a lot of young people trying to oust older politicians, even when there's very little ideologically separating the contestants from one another. Where I think Americans have not gotten yet is seeing that politicians are just the tip of the iceberg, and in a way, Joe Biden was the tip of the tip, because gerontocracy is really a social phenomenon that is much more correlated and dangerous, because it's affecting the electorate and private wealth. Think about it. If Donald Trump doesn't make it, for whatever reason, as president for one more year, America will immediately have its youngest president in its history.
I didn't realize that. That is the most remarkable thing, that Vance is a youngster.
He's not just a youngster, but he's younger than Theodore Roosevelt was, so far our youngest president. And so my reason for mentioning that is that were that to happen, it would not just be sad for Donald Trump's family. It would mean that we would forget about gerontocracy, and yet it would remain as real as ever, because it's not just about the politicians. Wouldn't much matter what the age of the politicians are if the voters were so old and money was so old.
In the moments we have left, Sam, I would like you to say something moving about the wisdom of the old, the experience they bring to public affairs, their indispensable role in making for a civilized society. Could you give it a go?
Well, I'm going to have trouble. You might have to call another guest, but I do think we should defer to older people and access the unique experience that everyone across the lifespan has. I do sympathize with the old Greek philosopher Aristotle, who remarked that older people who are renowned for wisdom may just be repeating the same mistakes over and over. However, I think what we should ultimately strive for is intergenerational solidarity and therefore a kind of balance, a way in our politics of being fair to all age cohorts, accessing the unique contributions that different age cohorts can bring to the table. And therefore, it's essential not just to be kind and to older citizens, but also to find a way for them to have a voice. The problem is that they're drowning everyone else out right now.
How dare you say that of me? Sam, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Moyne, the Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale University, is the author of this new, extraordinarily interesting book, Gerontocracy in America. And this is Late Night Live. Coming up, a white child in black country. Novels and memoirs by whites who grew up in the bush with beloved Aboriginal people a century or so ago aren't rare. Australiana, they were called in their publishing heyday. Stories particularly of white children taken into the lives of the Aboriginal families working for their parents, usually, on remote stations. Alice Duncan Kemp was one of these. She grew up before the First World War with the Mithika people of the Channel Country north of Katithonda, Lake Eyre. Her books began to appear in the 1930s, but later, as my guest today, Tom Griffiths, writes, they were written off as fantasy until their rescue, in part, by him. As he writes in his new book, Alice's Dreaming, it slowly dawned on me that Alice might be writing the truth. The poetic truth of her work is unassailable, but the literal truth of her testimony has also come to matter very much, for it's a bridge to the future. Tom Griffiths is, as you know, one of the leading historians in this country, with more than a dozen books to his credit over the last 40 years, the sort of books that have shaped our understanding of this place. Tom, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Who was Alice?
Alice was born in 1901, died in 1988, and she grew up on this remote pastoral station in the Channel Country of southwest Queensland. That's between Birdsville and Windora, where the great rivers, the Cooper, the Diamantina, the Georgina, flow down with rains from the northern monsoons, bringing that water into Katithanda Lake Eyre. And it's a wondrous country, and she felt it was a wonderland.
And as a tiny kid, she was placed in the care of a woman we know as Mary Ann. Who was Mary Ann?
Mary Ann Kumunda was a Mithika woman. She was a herbalist. She was deeply respected within her people. And she was also she was in charge of the household staff at Murubiri, the domestic staff. And she lived a little way away on the creek in her gunya with other Mithika people. And each day she'd come up to the homestead and she had to change her clothes. She had to wash her head every day. And then she was ready to look after the children.
But she took Alice into the bush.
She did.
From what age?
Yes, from at toddler age.
Toddler?
Oh, indeed, on her hip as a bub, you know, because she would take the children on walkabouts. That's how they learnt their country. That was where the most important playtime was and where the serious schooling took place, on country, anywhere within walking distance of the homestead.
But then later, droving.
Indeed, and Alice, as many children did and still do, you know, on pastoral stations. Alice became involved in real stock work from a young age. And so she was out there camping under the stars with Aboriginal stockmen and women, as well as settler stockmen. And she would be there to hear the campfire stories, to ask questions. She was a very curious, serious-minded, earnest child.
With a good memory.
With a good memory. And she did begin writing things from quite early on. And
notes.
Notes. And she says that she started writing her first book in her head from almost the time she was sort of 10 or 12. And I do think her books capture that sort of innocence of childhood.
Was there anything that the Mithika people withheld from her that you know? Or was she taught everything that a Mithika girl would have been taught?
That's a great question, and I can't really answer it because I do know that knowledge was withheld from her as a child, but also as a white child. And she was aware of that, particularly as she grew up. She asked lots of questions. She wanted to get to the sort of heart of things, to understand Aboriginal culture and stories. So she was asking questions, and sometimes, you know, answers were not given, or a stony silence would be provided. And when they were out on walkabout, they would be led past dangerous places. Perhaps it wasn't signalled that that's what was happening, but she became aware that they were being protected from some of the dangers of beloved
country. There was an odd, unexpected change of direction, and she worked out what that was.
That's right. Sometimes it was explained to her that this was something she couldn't understand or was dangerous.
And she spoke the dialects?
She says that she did, and that there were several of them. And I think she understood many of them because this is a time when the invasion, the European invasion, has really concentrated Aboriginal refugees onto safe and kind stations like Murubiri. So many of the people that she grew up with came from other districts and they had brought their languages with them. So she did learn quite a range of words and languages.
You suggest right at the very end of the book that the Mithika people may have seen in her someone who could safeguard knowledge that was under threat.
Yes, isn't that extraordinary? And I do think that happened.
A white child.
Yes, and I think it happened on a lot of frontiers across Australia. We know of other instances where sympathetic whites, powerful white people, are chosen as brokers of knowledge, as people who might help safeguard knowledge and ensure that it continues on. Because this is a war-torn, traumatic world, and that becomes apparent in the background of this wonderland that Alice describes, that actually it's a war-torn world and greatly disrupted one. And the Mithika people are trying to find people who are willing to help them survive and also for their knowledge to survive.
Now, Alice was a witness to, wrote about, some extraordinary events in Channel Country. One of these is the Debney piece.
Yes, this is something that really secured my interest in Alice's work and to try and work out if we could rely on her testimony, because this is a unique account, a memoir, oral history of an event called the Debney Peace after George Debney, who was a local, esteemed local pastoralist. And it took place in 1889 over 5 days. It was a traditional Aboriginal gathering for initiation rites and so forth, but they added to it a really solemn ceremony to try and draw a line across the slaughter that was taking place across the Channel Country. And so it was at night by a fire. It involved exchanges of torches and artifacts, and it was a solemn occasion. And it really did, it seems, bring about an end to the worst of the slaughter. And the worst of the slaughter was being perpetrated by the native Maori police.
And Alice heard about this. Obviously, she wasn't a witness to it, but
right.
She heard about it. And you place the Debney Peace in the context of agreements, not treaties, but small agreements in the bush that there be peace.
Yes. So there's far more of them than we know about at the moment. And I think this is a bit of a challenge to us to try and dig out these informal agreements and learn more about them. And they're little known and often unrecorded because, of course, the British government, the governments, did not want to recognise that there was an undeclared war taking place. They didn't want to recognise sovereignty of the peoples whose lands they had invaded. And to talk treaty, to even have formal negotiations to end war was something that called out the fiction of that this, you know, the fiction of terra nullius, and that these lands actually belonged to another people.
So on the one hand, there was the Debney Peace, but there was also, in her writing, accounts of the rebellion, the Kurungura. And this, explained to us, seems to be a point where the indigenous people, fed up, start to push back. But you're wondering whether it actually happened.
Well, it's a good question, and I think we should contest every bit of evidence we have about a difficult and traumatic period of history. But there are thousands of words of Alice's about the Kurungura, or the Aboriginal Rebellion, and there are many other examples of similar phenomena across Australia where almost like a last-ditch attempt to reject the intruders and also to reinforce local law. So it was doing both those things, punishing collaborators, but also enforcing traditional law and trying to revive all of the old stories and the joy in them. And so the Kurungura is not all bad for the Aboriginal people or the white people in the sense that it brings a sort of like a travelling theatre of resurgent songs and stories and dances that sing their way across country in the second decade of the 20th century in this part of the channel.
Roughly during the First World War.
That's right, yeah. And so it's what I find intriguing is that we've really only in recent decades been prepared to recognise that we had frontier wars in Australia. And now we're learning that there are treaties, there are negotiations, there are rebellions.
There are strategies, exactly. There are warriors,
Indeed, it's a very grim but also rich history that is emerging from the Australian wars.
I hadn't realised until I read the book that you can date the time when Australia became interested in the outback in a slightly different way in the 1930s, when books began to appear, like Alice's books, and Walkabout magazine. That was still going when I was a kid, of course, Walkabout magazine. What do you think allowed Australians to be curious about the bush in this way?
Yes, it really is a change, as you say, in the 1930s, from sort of the dead heart to the red centre, and the pulsating heart of inland Australia becomes Uluru. And I think partly it's happening because of air travel. And so urban Australians are learning that, my goodness, it is a red centre and the colours out there are extraordinary.
There's a lot of it down there when you're flying to Darwin.
there is. And so I think air travel really begins to awaken urban Australians to the wonder of their hinterland and to its terrifying and fascinating difference. And the outback writers, of course, they're telling stories about that land, but also about Aboriginal peoples. And so Australians in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, and through Walkabout magazine, which was in my home as I grew up too, you're learning stories about Aboriginal people who are still on country and still managing it in learned and dynamic ways.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Tom Griffiths about his book, Alice's Dreaming. It was in that context, Tom, wasn't it, that Alice produced her first book. Now, why did she write it? What drove her to write the first of her memoirs?
Her childhood was enchanted. It was happy. You know, this is what first attracted me to her writing, that these should be happy memories from early 20th century Australia of her relations with Aboriginal people on their own country. So she's filled with the joy of that, but also with a great sense of grief and sadness by the 1920s and 30s as the beloved teachers, Mithika teachers that she's known, begin to die. And as after the First World War in 1919 and 20, the Spanish influenza sadly sweeps through many people in inland Australia, and Alice and her family lost 40 Aboriginal friends in just a few weeks from that. And she feels that the land that was alive with song and dance and story is now depopulated and empty. And when she goes back there, she feels, she misses that. She feels this is an orphaned country. And so she's beginning to write that nostalgia. There is romance in her writing. She's beginning to write that missing into her childhood memories. This was a book, that first book, a book she was always going to write. And she presents it, you know, as a finished piece to Angus and Robertson in 1932-33.
And it's published. Another one is published. And then in the 1960s, she presents another manuscript to Angus and Robertson and strikes trouble with a capital T.
She does. She gets a firm letter from Beatrice Davis, the esteemed publisher at Angus and Robertson, an editor, saying, we cannot publish this book. In fact, we cancel the contract because we believe you have appropriated phrases from the South African writer Laurens van der Post. And because of that, we can't proceed. And Alice says, okay, I accept that, and I don't know about copyright so much, and I'm sorry. And this story about her plagiarism, and that's what it is she keeps quiet about that. She's embarrassed by it, I guess, and it's something that it took me a long time to be able to talk about and investigate with her descendants as well, although they've been absolutely supportive of this whole research project. And
curiously, she was pinching stuff from a writer who we now know pinched stuff on a huge scale.
Yes, and that's the irony in a way, that Laurens was a compulsive plagiarist, a serial liar, and a master fabricator, infamous for his fabrications. And so for a while, before I could get my hands on the full evidence, it was worth exploring, as her family wondered, you know, did he plagiarise Alice? So I chased that particular story up the garden path for a while.
Yes, but unfortunately that doesn't come true. It's a very nice idea. It involves the Blitz and London and things, but it doesn't pan out. But when did you decide that it was worth this huge creative investment to work out if Alice could be trusted? And what in the end is your verdict?
So we've mentioned when we've used the word plagiarism, so one would be tempted to just sweep the whole work aside. So since it's become so important, you know, it's this unique ethnographic testimony about the culture of peoples who've been dispossessed of their country, although they've hung on to it as well. So we do need to know if we're going to rely on Alice's evidence. And so my verdict, and it's one that I've been able to chase down with help from a number of other scholars, my verdict is that Alice's work is at its heart reliable, that the core of her memories are true, and the various ways in the book that I show one can chase these ideas down. So the core of her remembered experience is true, and that she drew on inspiration from other writers from time to time, and sometimes other anthropologists, where she wanted to elaborate her own experience, to explain it better to the Australian public, or in some cases, as with van der Post, she was aspiring to find ways of expressing herself better. And she was always trying to train herself to be a better writer. So, and I come to that conclusion by looking very closely at the relevant passages to find out whether or not this is stylistic or whether it is substantive. And I come to the conclusion that her work can be relied upon, that it remains very important, and we can corroborate our own experience through all sorts of other sources, including...
It's the corroboration that becomes the intellectual excitement of the second half of the book, because we're talking about a little girl's experience in the Channel Country in the years before the First World War. Now, at first glance, you would think, how can anything there be corroborated? But what this book showed for me is the astonishing extent to which incidents in the bush can be corroborated.
That was the excitement for me as a writer and a scholar too. You know, can I find these people? Did they exist? Is Alice's stories of country true?
Was there a dust storm?
Was there a dust storm of that scale? And right down to wonderful work being done on country today, led by Mithika people, on botany, on archaeology, all of which corroborates very strongly, surprisingly well, Alice's written testimony. Jen Silcock is a gifted ecologist who's been working on that country for many years, and she's been able to identify about 900 or more accurate descriptions of plants from that country. In about 200 of those cases, they're uniquely described and they're true, and she can find them on country again. And sometimes she's been able to, and not only that they exist, but their life cycles are recorded by Alice because she lived there and she watched them over time. She didn't just visit and disappear again. She lived there and she watched the life cycles of plants and she recorded them. And sometimes Jen's been able to find, you know, rare plants exactly where Alice said they are.
She loved plants. I mean, Alice was nuts about plants. There was another thing about Alice that I loved, which is that Alice wasn't bored by Aboriginal ceremony. That other white witnesses to Aboriginal ceremony found them tedious, really quite unendurable. But she watched till dawn.
She did. Baldwin Spencer famously found Aboriginal ceremonies, which he recorded at length, you know, a bit boring and didn't hang around for the completion sometimes. But Alice would never let a moment pass, and she was enthralled. She'd get a front seat. She'd often be led to a front sitting position at these kinds of ceremonies because Mithika people knew that she was interested and that she was, you know, their privileged mediator, really. And she paid close attention and she loved it.
She didn't live in the bush after she married. She lived in town. But she appears to have taken an awful lot of paper with her. There is an archive, you say.
There is. Well, she lived in country towns, or she had some country properties, but she wasn't right out in the remote Channel Country in her later years. And yes, she created a midden of manuscripts. Some of them are her original notes. Many of them are her writing and rewriting and rewriting of the stories of her childhood. So this is how one can kind of also test her evidence. How consistent are those stories? So way before she met or read Laurens van der Post, way before he wrote anything, she was telling the same stories in her manuscripts. You know, that's the consistency that remains there. Sure, she borrowed some phrases that might sort of liven it up in some different kinds of ways when she was in her late 60s looking for sort of ways to reframe her work. But the stories are there and it layered right through this great archive that her family has kept, and I'd like to give a special shout out to her daughter-in-law, Dawn Duncan Kemp, who really helped. Dawn died a few years ago, but she really was the wonderful custodian and archivist of these papers, and she really introduced me to them.
The lesson, if I can say such a, you know, a blunt thing of the book, to me is, again, how much survives, and that the notion that you were given when you first went out to the Channel Country, oh, the Mithika people have disappeared, was bullshit, and that we should recognise this as dangerous bullshit, the notion of disappearance.
Yes. There's been a sort of third wave of dispossession, really, that across pastoral Australia. You know, the first one is the invasion and the massacres. The second one are systematic removals of people. And the third wave is a tsunami of commissioned Shire histories that have written Aboriginal people out of the history of their own country. And that is part of the story that I get into late in the book. And Alice's work is working directly against the grain of that official history. She's telling a very different story. And so the real joy and surprise to me, David, was that I was able and entrusted to tell the story of Mithika people on their own country, and that they really gave me the responsibility, in the sense that they did to Alice 100 years earlier, they gave me the responsibility to tell their story through the 20th and into the 21st century. And it's a marvellous story of endurance and resilience, of just clinging to country and constantly being removed from it and then walking and finding their ways back to it. And they have never left Mithika country.
You've organised the book so that it opens with three of the most beautiful chapters, which is Alice's account of her own childhood. Now, Tom, I take it that every fact there has been checked, every fact you are secure with, and that the readers of the book will be taken into a world that is true.
No, I haven't checked every fact.
What?
In the opening three chapters, because it's a game that I'm playing with the reader, in the sense that I am really channeling Alice. I am drawing on her testimony. And in many cases, yes, I can corroborate what's happening, but not in all the detail. It's only Alice that provides that detail. So I want the reader to experience the enchantment of her childhood before stepping back alongside me to scrutinise the evidence. So I come in chapter four with the hammer blow of history. You know,
yes,
this is what this enchanting world, actually, it was a traumatised world of war, and that the people who cared for Alice were survivors of war and of massacres. And then begins the historian's task. Okay, reader, do you feel the magic and wonder of these early chapters? Then let's together see if we can rely on them. Can we really believe that this is what happened on country in Alice's childhood? Is she making it up or is it true? And I hope, I think, what emerges, but it's out there for people to contest, I think what emerges is that her memories are strong, they're consistent, they can be corroborated, and yes, they are extraordinary.
Tom, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David.
I've been talking to Tom Griffiths, author of Alice's Dreaming, which has just been published by Black Ink. And that's the show and the week, which means it's time for Chatterbox, when we read your emails and humbly accept quibbles, corrections, and of course, compliments. One of Australia's first Indigenous medicos, Lewis Peachy, a Girimay and Dhirubal man, thanked us for interviewing Annabel Stafford about the Wyndham Native Hospital. Annabel, he writes, made the point during the conversation that a principle behind the Wyndham Native Hospital was the prevention of diseases crossing from Aboriginal people into the white community. But that focus lingered a long time, he writes. Even 25 years ago, the risk of spreading infection was key to Indigenous patients across Australia being given serious medical attention. The shadows of our colonial past, he wrote, hang heavy on our present day. Sad news about the last fax ever sent to Late Night Live. We couldn't find it in the end. And we've taken a radical move. We have now removed from the Radio National website the fax. So if you want to contact Late Night Live, faxes are dead, but every other way is open. As always, my thanks to the team. Producers Catherine Zengra, Anne Arnold and Ali Benton, and executive producer Jack Schmidt. We'll all be back next week.